This week's episode of Worst Ever Podcast is brought to you by Chatbooks. As a mom, I'm always terrified of losing my photos. I think all you moms out there can relate. I mean, I recently accidentally dropped someone's phone, and there was like a 30-minute window there where I didn't know if we were going to be friends again because of all the photos she might have lost. Thank God we recovered them. So Chatbooks is awesome for me because it literally creates your own book, like from your Instagram, from your camera roll, from your Facebook, whatever it is, it automatically creates these photo books for you. You can have multiple photo sources in one book, and multiple people adding photos to your book. Every 60 photos you post or choose are then just automatically printed, and they just send you the book. Like, you don't have to do anything. It's amazing. You get 60 pages in a book for only $8. I mean, there are more pictures of my child in my phone. I need to get them off, and I need to get them into a book for posterity, just for my sanity alone. So go to chatbooks.com and you can get your first series book free with promo code WORST. That's right, free. I love free shit. Who doesn't love free shit? Oh, and speaking of free, when you sign up, it's free shipping in the US. I mean, come on. Chatbooks.com, promo code WORST. Welcome to Worst Ever Podcast.
Welcome to Worst Ever Podcast.
I am your host. Christine Lakin.
Ala Khaled. Khaled Khaled.
How do you say that name?
Well, it depends. It's either sometimes it's Khaled, sometimes it's Khaled, sometimes Khaled.
Because for years I was always like Allah Khaled. Allah Khaled.
Allah
Khaled.
Well, it's not Allah, it's Allah.
Okay. Allah Khaled. And then but then your brother says it Khaled, but it can be either, is what you're saying.
Well, it's Khaled Khaled. That's his name.
No, I know that. Yeah. But it wouldn't be Khaled Khaled. That's
weird. I think
weird.
It's because of Allah and Khaled, it's hard to say, so I say Allah Khaled.
I see. It just depends on my mood. So you're the one who's changing
it.
Tomato.
But it's really Khaled.
Khaled.
Yeah, like you're catching some phlegm.
Khaled. Is that right?
Khaled.
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 Yeah.
Okay. Now that I've spit all over Stephen Ray Morris's microphones, welcome to the podcast. Before we get into our first guest, I just wanted to do a little shout out to some of our fans. It's amazing that we have some, and thanks so much if you are a fan.
That we have some? Is that what you
said? Yeah, I think it's amazing, and I really appreciate when people listen, subscribe, and certainly write us and tell us what they like and don't like about the podcast. If you want me to have perhaps a new co-host, if you want to say anything about, some of the way that Allah interjects and how annoying it is, I welcome those comments. But this one in particular comes from Christina. I'm just going to name her by first name. She says, keep up the good work. Hi, Christine and Allah. I wanted to let you know I really enjoy your podcast. There isn't one pod. Yes, because that's how the kids say it. When I thought, well, that one was the worst ever. Love the puns. All of your guests are fun, and I wanted to let you know to keep up the good work. Just another fan, Christina. P.S. I love how Georgia makes her appearance on the pod. Ha ha. Thank you so much, Christina, because I love those little moments too, even though some people want to call CPS and just kick her out of the room. Anyway.
You notice I haven't commented.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Today on the podcast, we have a very funny actress. She's a friend of mine. Her name is Carly Gibson.
She's amazing.
She's amazing. Carly Gibson, you would know if you were a theaterphile. She was Tracy Turnblatt in the first national tour of Hairspray.
And then ended up on Broadway.
She also was in the musical Cry Baby, which was a fast in, fast out for those
Lasted
of you.
Lasted like 2 months.
But she's going to talk about some of her ups and downs in the business and
her highs and lows.
Her highs and lows, if you
no
will.
No pun intended.
No, pun's intended, I think, actually, on that
well.
One. She and I met doing Scream, a musical parody at Rockwell here in Los Angeles. She's super funny. She's very talented. And she has two huge shows coming out. One you must see is coming out in August. It's Greg Garcia's new show on TBS called The Guest Book. And then the next one is the second season of One Mississippi, which is going to be on Amazon in September. She's having a huge year. Anyway, I'm very happy for her, and she's a delight and has some really awesome, insightful stuff. So enjoy.
It was enough time with her, I feel.
I will. We're going to have to do a recap with her.
Yeah.
We need to have her back.
for sure. Oh, and if you have anyone you want us to have back, let us know. And we'll see if, you know, they're available. Okay. Enjoy.
The worst moments of our life.
Hey, girl. Hey, that's bad.
So speaking of, like, worst ever experiences.
That is the worst ever.
I don't feel so good.
And that was my worst audition ever.
How bad can it be?
And we feel the pain is best or funny.
All right, so we're with Carly Gibson, and we went through her credits, which are insane.
Aw.
It's for real. And Christine is on her way back from a meeting. She's a bitch. She's going to call in, and then she'll dive in when she gets here, which will be any minute now, because she'll make an entrance, of course. All right, so I'm just slowly, while we were waiting for Christine, I was slowly getting to know Carly a little bit on a personal level. And I want to talk about, let's just start with your career, like how it started, because you're one of those statistics where you're like, how the fuck did that work out? You know what I mean? But we were discussing about age.
Yeah.
Because you started so young. Yeah. and you being fearless in a sense of like, I'm going to make it. Yeah. And it worked in your benefit. Now, had there been a Schwab's here, where it's not one of those moments, but it's like, it's sort of fascinating your mental state on how you came about doing what you're doing now. So let's start from the beginning and high school.
Yeah, I mean, I got involved, you know, to be honest with you, musical theater was never really my jam. I was about 6 years old, and my parents were super into rock and roll music. They were big hippies. And they brought me to this festival called Parties in the Park. And I saw this cover band playing, and they had this lead singer, this badass chick. And she was singing, like, you know, REO Speedwagon and Meatloaf and all these things, and she was killing it. And I had this, like, catharsis at 6 years old, standing in this park being like, that's what I want to do. I loved rock and roll. I wanted to. But unfortunately, you know, there wasn't a lot of openings for a lead singer, a six-year-old, to be lead singer of a rock band in my hometown. So I naturally fell into theater. That's sort of where the outlet led me to. And so I started, and I loved it. I will always have a soft place in my heart for musical theater, or soft place just on my body, known as my asshole.
Is it soft?
For musical, I think, yes. I think it's getting softer.
Oh, nice.
As time goes on. Age is funny like that. Certainly not as tight as it once was. But then again, you know, my 20s, it was a rough time.
Well, we're going to get into that.
it's also known as the period of time where I didn't love myself. So I really got into theater, and then I started working professionally when I was like 15. I got hired to play Little Red in Into the Woods in this civic production, and like a town away from.
Where are you, by the way?
In Michigan.
Okay.
We're in Michigan. And so Central Park Players was Grand Havens Theater. Shout out to Central Park Players. Probably debunked. I don't even know. But I got hired to do that, and it was super rad. Like, I was like, yeah, this is totally what I want to do. And so the following summer, I got hired through Cherry County Playhouse, was our regional theater company in Muskegon, Michigan. And they were huge. They were one of the biggest regional theater houses that is now gone. They've gone under. But they were doing this really cool show called Crash Nation. And it was essentially like... It was like a rock opera, and it was eight kids. It was four boys and four girls, and they had to be teenagers. And there was a massive call for it in the paper. And it was this New York writer, Bill Castellino, and Christopher McGovern and Bill Whitefield, who Christopher McGovern had created the Lizzie Borden musical.
Oh, wow. And, okay, yeah.
And they were coming in. They had this new work. It was called Crash Nation. It was basically like Rent meets Stomp meets Schoolhouse Rock. But we dealt with like real things. So in this town, it was like, we dealt with coming out, and we dealt with the Columbine murders, which were big at the time, and we dealt with abortion and having sex for the first time and bullying and not fitting in and all this stuff. And this is like 2001.
Oh, wow.
And so it was pretty irreverent, and it was the world premiere of it, and so it was a big deal. And during that time, this agent, Brad Adams, who was Bill Castellino, the director and creator's agent, had flown in from New York to see the show because they were going to move it to New York. And so he had come in to see it, and I remember I'll never forget that night because, you know, of course, we're all backstage and we're like, there's a New York agent here. And like everybody was like running around. I mean, it was the most ridiculous.
No,
it was very
I
Guffman.
Feel that. Yeah.
Like it was very Guffman. You know, it was like, we might be going to Broadway. we were all just too excited. Because in your mind, especially at that age, that's how you think that that happens.
And you're
somebody
15.
Somebody just sees you. Right. Yeah. Somebody just sees you and then all of a sudden you're.
And you're probably you're a star. Starring in the production.
Right. Right.
So in small town America.
Oh my God.
So you're like the big fish in the.
Of course. Right. So it was this big thing. So I met him afterwards. It was very. I mean, he was like, we had this restaurant underneath the theater called the City Cafe, and he was at this big round table in the back. He was like way in the corner and they were like, Mr. Adams would like to meet you. And so I was like all nervous. And I had an eyebrow ring and like cornrows because that was a thing at the time. I promise that was a thing at the time. And so I like walked over and I was like, hello, Mr. Adams. And I shook his hand. And he was like in this suit and whatever. And he was like, great performance, whatever. And that was it. And he didn't change my life. And he didn't buy me a plane ticket to go to New York. And I was devastated. And I was like, fuck this place. And so I was like, now I got to go back to my stupid school with the stupid people. And like, so mad. And then. And halfway through my senior year, I'd gotten this. My mom came to the school. I was in sixth hour. I had independent study with my choir teacher, which basically meant I did nothing. And so she came in and she was like crying. And I had instantly had like a bunch of family members die that year, just randomly.
Yeah.
So she showed up and she's like crying. I'm like, fuck, who died now? And she's so hysterical. And so she comes in and I'm like, what's going on? And she's like, Broadway called. And I was like, huh? And we were so naive that like in my mind there was like a corporation, right? Where it was like Broadway Inc. And they were, there was just like people there on phones and like that's how it worked. Like the all of Broadway just called you on the phone. And I was like, what are you talking about? Well, she had gotten a call from Brett Adams and Hairspray at the time was in Seattle. Doing their out of town before they came in. And he was like, look, there's this new show coming out. It's really hot. We think that she's perfect for it. Would she be able to come in and audition? So we called him back and I was like, yeah, I'll be there. Whatever we have to do. And he was like, okay, well, sit tight. We'll let you know what's up. So I went back to the school and I was like, you guys have no idea what you're dealing with now. I was like, I got a call from Broadway and I'm going. And okay, I mean, we just had no idea.
But hold on a second. So do the other cast members from the show know that they specifically called you?
Well, this was the phone call happened about 6 months after. So some of us from the show were at the same school. Some of us weren't. We were all still friends. But yes, at that time, I mean, I told everybody like I was so excited.
But were they bitchy back?
No.
They were excited.
I think everybody was. It was really weird. I think everybody we were all just really confused. I don't think I was conveying it very well because also I didn't know what was happening. So. I told everybody and then we didn't hear anything for like 2 months. So then of course everybody was like, she made it up. She never got a phone call. She is not going to Broadway. And I was like, no, you're ruining my life. So I was like hounding this agency on a daily basis, like had their personal number and would call from my house phone and be like, can I talk to Brett Adams? Which later on realized like, you never just call and ask for the man who owns the company. You have a representative, an agent that's assigned to you.
Right.
But I was like 16 at the time. So I was like calling and asking to speak directly to Brett Adams. And he was lovely and he would get on the phone and he was like, Carly, you know, they're in the workshops. We don't know what's happening with the show. We're going to keep you posted. I was like, okay, but like, here's the deal. I'm trying to decide if I'm going to finish high school or go to college. So like, I need to know if this is going to happen. And he's like, again, can't really give you a lot. You haven't even been in for it yet. Don't know if they'd even cast you. I was like, okay, well, I'll just deal with this on my own. So I flipped a coin and I was kind of flunking out of school as it was already. And
not kind of. You don't kind
I,
of.
I was like pretty much not okay. going to graduate.
Okay.
And I had a lot of absences. Yeah, no. They were like, it's not going to happen. You're going to have to go to adult ed. And I was like, not on your life. So not that I have anything against adult
Listen.
Ed, but in my hometown, the people that went to adult ed were like, it just call it. Just go ahead and call it. Like it's over. So I decided that I was just going to go to New York. I'd always wanted to go to New York. It was my dream. And so I sort of threw a fake graduation party and told everyone that I was graduating early. And then I took that money and I moved to New York City with it. And it was funny because, hi.
Christine Lakin just arrived. Everyone hold.
I've been listening. One earbud. Oh. Hey, girl, hi. Okay, I'm here.
Christine Lakin is here.
Hi,
she's
guys.
A bitch.
Sorry.
All right, so wait a minute. You fake.
You're flunking out of school.
You fake a graduation party.
I surely did.
So for family members?
No, for everyone. Like family, everyone.
So your mom's a part of this fake graduation party?
Yeah, kind of. Well, what I had sort of promised is that I would take these correspondence classes and that I would get my diploma later. And the school sort of agreed to this. They were like, if you can finish these correspondence classes by, I think the cutoff was like July 24th or something, then we'll still honor your thing. But like, I knew I was going to New York. I was like, I'm not doing these courses.
How old are you?
Classes. I was 17. I had not turned 18 yet.
Wow.
So I was like, I was like, correspondence classes. Yeah. And so I made like $2,500 at my graduation party. And I was like, that's it. I'm out. And my mom was like, oh, and she like begged me. She was like, just finish school. And I was like, I don't need it. I'm not doing math. I don't need math and science and stuff.
I'm a singer.
Yeah. I was like, I know how to balance a checkbook. I feel like I'm good to go. So I moved to New York and...
Okay, wait.
So you are 17.
She's 17.
Like,
so,
peace out. I'm going to New York by myself.
Okay, so wait. I want to hear about this process because, A, you got to find a place to live.
I had a friend. So one of the guys, his name is Leonard Sullivan. He's actually here in town right now doing Mormon at the Pantages.
Oh.
Shout out to Leonard.
Shout out to Leonard.
I had met him that summer that we did Crash Nation together, and he was 5 years older than I was. He had already moved to New York. So I was like, hey, girl, hey, coming to live with you. He was like, I live in a shoebox. I was like, great, sounds great. So I was like, I don't care. I was like, as long as the zip code is somewhere in New York City, I don't care. So he housed me, and it was lovely, and we lived there and ate fried rice. He was like working for catering at the time, and we had no money, and he would come home and bring home those tiny little bottles of booze, and we would get ham, like just fully ham sandwiched.
Oh my gosh.
On those tiny bottles of booze. And the crazy thing about that was, so then I lived there from like August of 2002 to April of 2003. And in that time, I had 10 auditions over 6 months for Hairspray. Like, they vetted the shit out of me.
My God. It's like a Rory O'Malley situation.
Oh, it's insane. And I think because I was young and they were like, what the fuck? They wanted to make sure that it wasn't a fluke and I could do it and whatever. So by the time I did end up booking it that following spring, I was so happy, obviously, but also out of money. And I couldn't work. Because I wasn't old enough to work, and I couldn't do anything, so I just sat in the apartment.
I'm trying to figure out how your mom and dad...
My mom trusted Leonard and completely... I mean, she just, listen, she knew me. She knew that this was what I was going to do, and there was no talking me out of it. Like,
so great. So, see, that's important, because you have to have that, like, support.
Yes, yeah.
Especially to right. go... Like, I explained to you, like, I moved to New York about 17, 18. I just graduated high school, and I told my dad... He took me on my first trip to New York, and I was like, you just made the biggest mistake of your life.
Yeah.
This is where I'm going to live.
On the other side, though, your dad cried and basically told you.
My dad cried.
Like, when you were going to live in the streets.
Yeah, well, pretty much. But at that time, it was a totally different time than when you're living there, because Broadway at that point is rejuvenating.
I think because I had this audition and because I was getting traction mm-hmm. with the callbacks and because she knew Leonard and she trusted him and she knew that she raised me right, I think that there was don't get me wrong, there were, you know, my mom watched a lot of Law and Order, so she was like, ah, Christ. that was like her big thing. But I think that because she had children really young and she had no regrets about it, but that was always her big thing. She was like, you can get married and have children whenever you want.
True.
But go see the world. Figure out who you are.
Yeah.
Do the things you need to do for you before, so that when you do decide to do that, if you decide to do that, you're ready to be a real mom.
Totally.
You're ready for it. You know what I mean? You're not begrudgingly doing it. So I think that was part of her, like, look, I wish you would do things a different way, but Lord knows I can't tell you to do shit because you're a fucking nightmare. And so... you know, you got to go. And she was an incredible support system to me. And I always knew that if worse came to worse, I had a safe place to fall.
Sure. Absolutely.
Sure. So, you could always go home.
And that's the age to do it, really, because...
You're fearless.
You're fearless. Yeah, and that's the topic for Carly. Yeah.
You got to be smart and fearless. Like, you can't be a dumb and just... because
well,
you
there's
get
two
yourself
ways.
In some really scary
situations.
Well,
there's naive and there's fearless,
right?
And at that age, you know, we were talking about this outside. It's like... as you get older, you become fearful because you experience disappointment, you experience loss, you experience mm-hmm. the other shoe dropping or the bottom falling out. And so it teaches you to become a little hardened and untrusting and doubtful.
And jaded.
Absolutely. And so you don't stick your hand out as easily. And I think the only reason I was able to thrive in that experience in the way that I did is because I had this idea that, like, well, I'll just work out. Everything will work out.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I didn't know any better. And even so, like, as the process went on, I was never afraid. You know, they cast me as the lead in this $11 million production. And people always ask me, like, were you fucking scared? And I was like, I wasn't, because I couldn't fathom it at the time. Now, to take on a responsibility like that, you really, you know, in a 360 way, you know what you're doing. But didn't.
But you said you had like 10 auditions that where they were vetting you into the whole hairspray.
Because you were new, too. You weren't in, you hadn't grown up on Broadway as a child.
And you knew, like, and your stage experience was Michigan.
Exactly.
Right. So totally different ball game.
Yeah, my resume read like Adelaide and Guys and Dolls.
Right.
Like,
so like
my high school.
Community theater
just
players.
Go to the audition process. Like, what were you singing for them? Like, what were they?
Hairspray stuff.
All Hairspray.
At the time, the show had just opened. So all the material was available. And I started off really early. I sang for Mark and Scott. I sang for Jack and Jerry, for Bernie Telsey, for the producers. Adam Epstein and Margot Lyon, like, I started going in for them right away. And then they started putting us through a little bit of boot camp. Like, we were doing crazy dance calls and scene work and all that kind of stuff. And by the end of it, I had performed almost the entire fucking show for them, because we had just done so much material. And it was funny, because as each audition would happen, like, we started off, there's probably like 30 girls. And as time went, by the very end of it, there were four of us. We knew by the very end of it that the four of us, were going to go somewhere, because Marissa was leaving New York and they were replacing the understudy that was current. I can't remember her name, but who was currently understudying Marissa, and that they were doing a tour and they'd need an understudy. So we knew they needed four girls, and there was four of us. There was myself, Kayala Settle, Shannon Durig, and Kathy Breyer. So we all kind of knew we were going somewhere. We just didn't know how we were getting placed. And Kathy was filming One Life to Live at the time, so they put her in New York, and then Shannon became her understudy, and then they put me out on the first national, and Kayala became my understudy. So that was really excited. I was excited to originate the tour, because they had all of the original production team, choreographers and directors and writers, come in and reset the tour and do it. And it was like creating the show again, because, you know, they got a chance to really do all of the things that they, you know, it's like having a second child, right? Like, you know, all the things that you did with the first one that you're like, ugh, you know, so we got to create some really special stuff. So that was really fun.
How long were you on tour with them?
I was on tour for 6 months. And crazily enough, so when I found out that I got it in April, we opened the tour in the fall of 2003 on my mom's birthday in Baltimore, which was cool.
Wow.
And right, so once I found out I booked it, I was like, cool, I'm going home, because I'm out of money. And we didn't start rehearsals for like 3 months. And it was the same year that all of my friends were coming home from college for the summer.
The ones that graduated.
Yes, the ones that actually graduated. So we partied our asses off. And then I got a phone call from Leonard, who I had stayed with, who was like, you're not going to believe this, but I just found out that I booked the tour. So we went on tour together.
What?
You're fucking crazy.
No,
did he play?
He played Thad and understudied Seaweed.
That's awesome.
And it was just the most serendipitous thing ever. Like, it was so insane. So then we went on, and then of course my mom was like, oh, she felt so good because
Leonard was with you.
Yeah. Leonard was with me on the tour. So
and it was all happening.
Crazy.
Isn't that insane?
But you sort of, like, I don't know, maybe you're futurizing, maybe you have like this gift, I don't know, right? Because you said before you left Michigan, it's going to work out, I'm going to get this job.
You know what it is, though? Here's what I'll say, and I tell this to a lot of people, especially now, like, I mean, and this may be something we talk about. I had this huge gap in my career, so I had these great Broadway experiences, and I did some shows, and then I had this sort of lull, and then I had just very recently this, like, revamp as I've been, like, you know.
I call them waves.
Yeah.
I say, like, a career
absolutely.
Is like riding the waves.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because there's always going to be a crest, and always going to be a fallout from it.
And here's the thing. For me, the fallout was very intentional. It's something I needed. I lost myself during that time. Like, especially during Hairspray, I made a lot of mistakes. I bought into my own brand.
Oh, we want to hear about it all.
And
that.
I partied too much. I got into drugs. I was missing shows. Like, I was a fucking nightmare.
Serious?
I was really rebellious. Yeah, I was. And I Listen,
you think because of your age and you were like, this came so easy, I'm good.
You know what it was? I didn't have a foundation in who I was, right? Like, uh-huh. I wasn't a person yet. I was still kind of a kid. And none of that's an excuse, but it's just a reality of my situation. And I became oddly rebellious against it because this is another reason I realized that musical theater wasn't for me. There's a mindset you have to have, and I call it the hamster on the wheel. I love a rehearsal process. I love creating.
Yes. 100%.
And then once the show is set, it's like, well, fuck, we just do this every single day for a year. And it just didn't stimulate me enough. And so I became
complacent.
Oh yeah. And a little bit like
bored.
I have this mentality. I tell my boyfriend this all the time because I'm like, I need the door to stay open. If you put me in a room, I could stay in that room for 16 hours, right? As long as I choose to stay there. But as soon as you shut the door and say you have to stay here for 16 hours, I think of nothing but leaving. I don't know why, but it has to be my choice. The door has to stay open. And for me, it was a door shut situation. I felt trapped. I felt beholden to it. I felt like I didn't have control of my life anymore. Instead of taking the mindset, which most people would be like, why weren't you grateful? You had job security. You had a dream role. I don't know. I can't answer that.
You can't answer that, A. And B, also, it's a lot of pressure because you are the star of the show. The show is based on
almost the whole thing.
Yeah, it's your show pretty much.
She's on stage all of but 15 minutes.
Right. So it's a lot of pressure.
And it's a long show,
and it's
too.
Almost, I mean, at your age, not coming from that world and sort of just like falling into it. And I don't want to say because you worked hard to be there.
Right.
But like falling into it. It's a big deal at 17, 18 years old to like be cast, and especially a tour, which is exhausting in itself.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Like if you were in New York just doing this, I think it would be tough, but you'd have all of New York and you would have a set group of friends you saw all the time. And when you're on tour, it's very isolating. No?
Oh, yeah.
Like you're in a hotel room.
Oh yeah.
I mean,
and I was young, so I couldn't do anything, right? I couldn't go out and party when people would go after the show. Like I was by myself a lot, and it was, I mean, don't get me wrong, I still found ways to party. Shout out to Rochester, New York, and that gay bar that used to let me in there all the time with the drag queens. But
you're like, we have an extension in Rochester.
Yeah, we are. We're staying here. So it was, but the rebellion really didn't hit until I got to New York, which was interesting. I really loved the tour, and I think because Leonard was there, those people became my family, and I felt, I say this, like, again, people are going to be like, oh, poor you. But I did sort of get ripped off the tour early. I was supposed to do it for a year, and I got ripped off 6 months in to go to New York. I felt very displaced. And New York was not the warmest of places to go because you had a group of people. Some had been there for a really long time. They weren't really interested in, like, the new girl who was, like, excited to be there, who they'd heard buzz about. They were punching clocks, you know what I mean? Time clocks.
Gotcha.
Like, that's just sort of, it was their job and whatever. And I was like, hey guys, are we all going to be best friends? And they were like, girl, I can't with you now.
Wow.
Like, I have hot yoga at 4:15 and like, I just can't with you. I have a child.
You get pulled off the tour because the lead on Broadway is, who is that at the time?
That was Kathy Breyer.
She's leaving.
Right. Yep. She was, I think they fired, listen, not my business, but I think they didn't renew her contract for whatever their own reasons were. And so therefore they were in need of someone to go. So when they pulled me off the tour and Harvey was leaving.
Okay.
And so they decided to, which this was unprecedented at the time, they decided, because they brought in Michael McKean to play Edna and myself to play Tracy. So they re-reviewed the show. So they completely went in and like cleaned up the show, and then they re-invited the press to come in, and that's how I got my New York review, like my first
cool.
New York
that's
review.
So cool. So where do you move to when you come back?
They put me up in an apartment at 55th and 9th Avenue.
That's nice.
Which is really cool. I was called the Hairspray apartment. And so I lived there, and I was like three blocks from the theater. And
you're making money now. Like, you're making more money than the tour, obviously.
Yeah, I was making good money. Like, I mean, I'll say what it was. This is, you can't make this kind of money on Broadway anymore unless you're Jake Gyllenhaal. But I, at the time, was making like $6,000 a week.
Wow, that's good.
And they were paying for my apartment.
That's high.
So, that's really high. In fact, when I did Crybaby, like 3 years later, I was still a principal role, and I think I made like 24.
Yeah.
The money just wasn't there.
Right.
So,
You have to be the lead in the show and work up to that. I have a friend that was on Broadway for many years, did all the tours, literally played a role for 10 years.
Yeah.
And I think with all the renegotiations after 10 years, probably worked up to something like
that. Well, but also, it's different for celebrities too that come in. Well, and of course, obviously yes. they make a
because of the ticket
Glenn Close
sales
is making like $40,000 a week, right. but she's fucking Glenn Close.
Right.
Like,
well, and she should get $40,000 a week.
To play
oh, say plus.
Never mind.
Never mind.
But okay, so wait a minute. So now you're in New York. You're in the middle of, you know, 55th and 9th, you said?
Yep, 55th and 9th Avenue.
So you're in the middle of Hell's Kitchen.
Yep.
You're starring on Broadway in a hit show. As a lead. You're getting buku.
It's weird to hear you say it like this. Well,
you're getting buku money. And then things sort of start spiraling.
And I was the unhappiest I'd ever been in my whole life. And okay. I didn't know why.
You were like happier with Leonard eating fried rice and getting drunk on mini bottles.
Yeah, right. That's exactly true.
Like you seem like you would be like ecstatic to be on a cruise ship tour.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Like it'd be like so much fun. Yeah. This is my life, you know?
Yeah.
But this like people like dream about.
Right.
Die
to do this, right? And like,
yeah.
This is an iconic role because it was such a hit, you know?
I mean, make no mistake, it's the best and most cathartic time in my life. And I will always be grateful to play that role. There were only 4 girls to ever play Tracy on Broadway.
That's so really
by the time that
well
it closed.
And
wow.
Crazy.
So to be in that company is an incredible honor to, you know, especially when you hear people, and I'm sure you've had this too, like when they tell you what that show means to them, what that role means to them, what, you know what I mean? That's what you do it for, you know? There was a lot. It was just a weird dichotomy of what was going on in my personal life and not knowing who I was and not having sort of a discipline and a sense of self-awareness and all of that. So, like, I put myself in therapy and started the process. But, you know, it was opening Pandora's box. And listen, on the other side of that, because I was doing all these things and had these opportunities, I had like a plethora of whatever I wanted available to me. Any club I wanted to go to, any fucking drug I wanted, anything. The car service would take you there. I mean, there were parties nonstop.
And you're 18.
Yeah, and there was, you know, there's celebrities at the show. You know what I mean? So it's just like, you kind of had this carte blanche to do whatever. Yeah. And that, like we were having this conversation about New Orleans, I cannot be in a place like New Orleans, even at, I'm going to be 33, even at the age of fucking 33, I cannot be in a place where somebody doesn't say, it's time to go home, right?
Right.
Like,
right.
You have to, like, I still can't do that for myself now. Eventually, when I left, I left 3 weeks before my contract was up because I had a rupture and they were like, if you continue singing, you'll never sing again. So of the potential of throwing this opportunity away, I felt like I had let so many people down. I felt ashamed. People were running their mouths left and right. People were like, she got fired. I was like, I didn't get fired. I mean, I was on the chat boards like trying to defend my own fucking honor. Like it was bad.
You're that girl.
It was bad. You know what I mean? I'm not that girl now, but I sure was then.
Yeah.
But it was a dark time. And again, like I said, the biggest problem for me during that time was I tell people this all the time. I bought into my own brand.
Sure.
Right. I bought into this idea of everyone being like, you're fabulous. You're going to be a star. You're going to be, you know, all this kind of shit. And you, if you don't have a genuine touchstone sense of who you are, and I did with my mom, but I was a nightmare. No one could, if you were going to tell me no, you had no place in my life.
Right.
I didn't want to hear it. I wasn't going to hear it from anybody. And
you have to like really grab your own balls with your own hands and say to yourself,
you're out of fucking
control. You're out of control.
Yeah.
Are
because
you doing
people
this?
Will spiral around you. And I think even more so in Hollywood, I don't know the New York scene as well, but when you're hot and you're the most popular girl at lunch table,
no one's going to tell you.
Everyone wants to tell you how great you are. Yeah. Then all of a sudden that job ends and it's like,
oh
the
my
claws
God,
come out.
That was the darkest point. I mean, I really found out who my real friends were after that. People I thought were my genuine friends were not. But yeah, it was really rough. And that for me, I think having to admit to my mom,
sure, where you were,
that this was happening, because she was so removed from it. You know, she was working and not in New York, and having to really say to someone out loud, especially in the mirror of the eyes of my hero, which was my mom, who had believed in me and given me you know, we grew up so poor. She sacrificed everything for me to have. She worked three jobs. Wow. She picked blueberries one summer, you know, so that I could go to theater camp. You know what I mean? Like, we had nothing. And I felt like, what a slap in the face to all of her sacrifice to end up like this. And I knew I was better than that. You know, this is sort of where I was going with. We talked about that feeling of like, oh, it's all going to work out. For me, I've always had this feeling ever since I was a little kid. I knew I was going to do this. Not I knew I was special. Not I knew I was going to be famous. I knew that this is what I was going to do. There isn't anything else that I do. So there just isn't another option. There is no or bust.
That's
right?
How we feel. Yeah.
Yeah. It is that. So for me.
That's why I always tell kids that want to get into the business. Yeah. I go, listen,
if you can think of anything else that you want to do, you're passionate about, or that you're good at,
or if you think you're going to just be a star and that's how it works, doesn't work that way. If you feel like there is nothing else I can do, this is it for me, then you're that one person out of the 50 here that should go pursue it and see what happens.
Because
it doesn't mean it's going to be a guarantee, but it just means that there's an inertia behind that passion that will keep
you going through the lulls.
Absolutely.
After the crest.
You have to love it because it will not love you.
I always
tell kids, and the other flip side of that is if you're not talented, learn math. And I mean that in the kindest way, but you have to be honest with yourself sometimes.
You do. And the very end of the day, everyone needs a goddamn accountant.
Everyone does.
Do you know, my accountant is like the most, he's such a nice guy, but he is so brutally freaking honest because he knows that it doesn't matter. Everyone needs his services come, you know, March,
April. He's not trying to be your friend. He doesn't care about hurting your feelings.
And he's lovely, but he'll say things to you like, oh, wow, you're building a new house? Well, that will be some capital gains. And you're like, listen, wah-wah, really?
Yeah.
Like, come on, man. Like, just have a positive side of something here.
No.
So you go home and you had this moment with your mom. And was she was there for you. She was understanding through this.
Yeah, and, you know, in a mother's intuition kind of way, she probably all saw it coming.
How old are you, by the way?
I had not turned 21 yet. I was 20.
Okay.
So in a lot of ways, I think she saw the demise happening only in the way that you can't expect necessarily. You can't see somebody on a path that I was on and think, this will end well. And so I think that she did have the foresight, but she knew me well enough to know I had to come to that conclusion on my own. I had to. It's the only way I do anything.
Most people, when it comes to that kind of lifestyle, they got to figure it out themselves.
Absolutely. Well, listen, I also come from a breed of people that don't do therapy. They self-medicate, right? I think a lot of us have that sort of come. It's also a generational thing. You know, people weren't trying to deal with their past issues. It was like, toughen up, you know, just fucking get through it and like, you know, go have a drink and shut your mouth. So sort of combating that old school way of thinking. I think sometimes my dad thinks I'm so touchy-feely and like new-aged in a weird way. And I'm like, no, dude, I'm not. I think I'm just trying to be honest with myself about who I am and what my weaknesses are and what my strengths are and where I'm at my most successful.
I was scared of everything.
Right.
Which sort of helped me in New York.
Yeah.
You know, I was just scared. I was like...
Well, like, you're not... You also have a background. Like, you're not even supposed to be drinking.
Right.
No.
Basically. Right. So you're already, like, probably feeling like there's one...
You're pushing it out.
Yeah.
But I took that time, and then I stayed in Michigan for, like, a year. And, you know, there was just a lot of things that went on. There was just a lot of disappointments, a lot of learning lessons. But essentially what happened is I came out of that, and then... decided that I was ready to go back to New York. I was ready to show my face again, and that's when Crybaby came about, and I had been working on that for so long.
This had gone on Broadway, because I was telling you off
not a lot of people
off the
did.
Pod.
It's great.
I was infatuated with the movie. I loved the movie with Johnny Depp, and my favorite person on the movie was Hatchet Face.
Yeah.
Do they have a Hatchet Face?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So John Waters was just as much a part of this as he was Hairspray in the making of the musical. It was a really... interesting experience for me because it was the first time I created a character, but it was also when I realized that I was not going to be a lifer in musical theater. I got a chance to really look at the process for what it was and saw sort of the demise of our show happening as it was happening and realized that a lot of it had to do with bullshit. You know, when we started taking out cuss words from the show because we couldn't sell to Christian school groups, and we had like brief nudity, and then we had to like kind of dim that down because then we couldn't get this, the, you know, the,
what year is this, by the way?
2008. So there was,
so this is during the time of Broadway where Disney's taken over Broadway, yes, pretty much.
Yeah. This is pre Book of Mormon.
This is pre
knowing that things with cuss words and crazy songs could actually sell tickets.
Right, exactly. Right. To those big groups. But you know, and then this is also at the beginning of the recession.
Right.
So a lot of things happened, and there was some you know, just bullshit going on behind the scenes, and when you are creating something with a group of people and you love it so very much and you see the potential, and then you see them make a decision that you're like, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. And it's hard because you're on this boat and you're watching the holes get punctured in it, and there's nothing you can do. And it's nobody's one fault. I think everybody had the best of intentions. Nobody was intentionally trying to sink the ship. Everyone put a shit ton of money in it, right? So no one's doing it on purpose. But
and just so the audience knows, it's a process when you're starting a new show on Broadway. It doesn't start. It's not like, oh, let's do a show and then it's going to go to Broadway. It's
the fastest I've seen one go is maybe from inception to opening night is like 5 years.
Yeah,
that's fast tracked. That's fast tracked.
Because you have to understand that directors, choreographers are booked on other shows,
right?
And so they have to work around their schedule. So they're okay, I can do this. We'll do it in La Jolla, and then I can do this in a year.
And doing readings.
You know?
And then you're doing out of town.
And you have to, you know what I mean? And casting.
And you have to get the right people to come to La Jolla to see it, to invest, to bring it to Broadway, the heavy hitters.
It is a fucking process. It is. So when you're working on something for that long, and we did, we loved it. You know, the cast will always have, we were open for 2 months. From the day we opened to the day we closed, we got nominated for 4 Tony Awards. We got nominated for Best Book, Best Music, Best Choreography, and Best Musical. And we didn't win anything. We should have won Best Choreography.
The choreography was
Rob
wonderful.
Rob Ashford choreographed this insane number, the prison jailbreak, where they tapped with license plates on their feet.
That was awesome.
And
that's
it was the most unreal thing ever.
YouTube
and we lost to In the Heights, which was a great show, but not for choreography. I mean, I'm sorry, Lin-Manuel. I live for you in everything that you do. Well, he didn't choreograph it, but I'm like, no. But
it's political.
The way the Tony Awards work is that the show that they think is going to tour and make the money is the show that wins the awards, because that's where they're putting money back into.
It's like the Cannes thing. It's like, so you get the, you know, the accolade on your poster that says it's a winner at Cannes, Cannes, whatever you want to say. It's a winner at Sundance. It's a winner at Slam Dance. You got to have the accolade to get people, because it's a saturated market, right? So you come into, you know, Los Angeles, which has never seen Crybaby before, and you're hoping that you can say Tony Award winning.
Exactly.
It doesn't matter what it is, lighting design.
Or they're going to say,
And they don't say best lighting.
Right. No.
You know what I mean? But no, you're absolutely right.
They don't say Tony nominated ushers.
Yeah, exactly.
Or should be.
Or the bullshit which is happening now. And this is another reason I decided to get out of that game and sort of, I'll always be grateful for it. There will never be a time that I won't turn the Tony Awards on and cry, right? I just love it so much. I do. But it wasn't for me. And then this weird thing started to happen where the money started to go, okay? And like I said, there was like a half price drop in pay that, you know, a pay cut that I saw just in the 3 years.
In pay cut for the cast?
No, I mean for like, so I went into Crybaby with a lead under my belt on my resume.
Yeah.
And having
like
set
a quote of money
and made about half that.
No. Yeah.
And so I started thinking, first of all, and I will always say this, musical theater in this realm of our industry, in the entertainment industry, is the hardest work you will ever do. When TV and film people bitch about their jobs being hard, I'm like, shut the fuck up. It is not hard.
I agree.
Physically and vocally and emotionally and mentally, you have no life. You do 8 shows a week. You get 1 day off a week.
Right.
You get 2 weeks off a year.
Agreed. But I will say this, totally 2 different beasts.
Two completely different beasts. Absolutely.
But, like, I would never say, theater is for the workhorse.
Right. Agreed.
Right.
That's why
the marathon runner.
That's why when celebrities go into a Broadway show,
they don't last long.
They have no stamina. They can do a month, 2 months. That's it.
And that's it.
everything. Yeah, because everything that a Broadway person is trained for their whole life, it's the vocal training, it's the dance training, it's the physical
stuff. But what people also don't
stuff.
Realize is you have no life when you're doing a Broadway show. There is no, you can't get on the phone and talk afterwards. Like you can't, well, I
it's so boring.
I'm
you
like,
have
you
to go
can't
home.
Go out and have a drink with your friends. You have to just like be a nun.
So that's the beginning of the end for you being like,
well, it was
fuck
that
this
and realizing that
shit.
Like,
is that the last show you did on Broadway?
On Broadway, yes. I did another show off Broadway. So then I started producing concerts. I did a show called that I wrote and starred in about my life. So what happened was it was called Not a Bitch, Not Yet a Woman. Yes, I stole it from Britney Spears. And what happened
as you
was,
should
listen, not ashamed. And basically what happened is so many people had run their mouth about my experience with Hairspray and what really happened and all those years and whatever. So I was like, fuck it. I'm going to tell the truth.
You want to tell your story.
I'm going to tell my story.
Good for
and
you.
I'm going to make you pay to come listen to it.
So you did. You created this own show. Yeah, you want to tell your story. That, where are you doing this? Like
at Joe's Pub. And it was like the anti cabaret because we did all rock and roll music.
By the way,
so here we go full circle.
We did Worst Ever at Joe's Pub.
I love the Joe's Pub. This was before the remodel.
Oh, okay.
This is like old school Joe's Pub. And I was like, so full circle, I was like, we're doing this with a full band and we're doing rock and roll songs. And so
awesome.
We did like Cher and Aerosmith and, I mean, we ran the gamut.
You sound like you're spending a lot of money. I'm just curious.
I spent no money. I got it all financed.
You did? Because I'm like,
what I walked away with after Hairspray, not to mention, okay, so there was just like a lot of shit going on in my life. I was sending a lot of money home. My parents split when I was like four, right? And so my dad went through some really tough times and I was sending a lot of money home. And it was just, people were hitting me up left and right. It was like a thing. But what I walked away with, this is another huge life lesson, versus what I made is really sad. Like, I think I walked away after 2 years of making that kind of money with like $35,000.
Wow.
In the bank. So, and you know, so it was tough, but I lived off that for quite some time and then did Cry Baby and made a little money there. And then I survived in New York for so long after that while I was producing concert series and doing that kind of stuff, but I would sing at gay bars. This is back in a time where you could make $600 a night singing at Splash or the Ritz or whatever. People were paying a couple hundred bucks at a time. You could host something for like $300. So I was doing
bitch can sing.
I was doing four or five of those a night.
I'm so sorry that I don't know your work.
We're
going to
put up some videos of this, of her singing.
So, I mean, I was kind of hustling and making my money that way. Plus, I was living off of unemployment. So between that and these like side gigs I was getting paid under the table and these concerts and stuff, which were selling really well, I was doing fine. Like, I was making it and I was happy. I was really happy because I felt like I was doing something. So then I started writing.
So, real quick, I'm sorry. You're going backwards because what you're doing now in your life is what you were supposed to do at 17.
Right.
The struggle.
Right.
Now you're doing the buildup of your career.
But weirdly enough, so much happier.
Right. Yeah.
But what I'm saying is she's experiencing
in reverse what most people do.
It's fascinating to me because.
But it's perfect, I think, because
absolutely.
I feel like sometimes in a career you have to learn a strange lesson early on because you don't know what's ahead, which we'll get to in a minute.
Right. Yeah.
No,
really?
it's so true. It's just,
no, I did.
I'm just
I like,
noticing. I'm like, okay, now she's doing the work, theater.
Well,
the music.
It gets more hustly. So I do that, and then I started. I've been working on this show called Fat Camp, which is as funny as it sounds. It's a musical.
Wait, was that a Kristen Hange thing?
No, it was a Kelly Devine.
Kelly Devine!
Yes, thank you.
We love Kelly. Kelly, shout out.
Oh, I love Kelly. So Kelly's one of my favorite humans on the face of the planet.
We just yelled into the microphones and
like,
Steven is like
my
blowing
fucking
ears out. Sorry. One more time, but it whispers. 1, 2, 3.
Kelly Devine.
So I've been working on that for a really long time. And then what happened? So we were going to move to Broadway, you know, that good old musical Coming to Broadway in the fall. Everyone's been cast in the musical Coming to Broadway in the fall.
Of course.
I'm curious real quick. Sorry. Side note. I wonder if Kelly choreographed Fat Camp like she did for Anorexic.
What do you mean?
Like, because of anorexic, she probably stole a lot of those moves.
from Anorexic?
Yeah, Anorexic was beautifully choreographed.
Why, I thought so too, yeah.
Okay, anyway, go ahead. Okay, go ahead. You never saw Anorexic, did you?
No, I didn't.
Ugh,
it was the retelling of Annie, but all the orphans were bulimic, but except for Annie, who was anorexic.
So it's Anorexic and the bulimic orphans.
That's amazing.
I played the Daddy Warbucks character.
Yes.
But I was Olivia Horbucks.
Sure.
And she was a lesbian.
Power lesbian.
Yeah, yeah, of course you were.
Of course, shoulder as you pads. Do. I mean, yeah. Of course. Yeah. I typecast again, guys.
Great. I have this theory that you can only know 100 things and you can only know 100 people. And then it's like that game where you put the quarter in and it pushes them off the edge. Like, once I meet a new person, somebody got shoved off the edge of the...
See, it's weird because I call it my friend basket.
Yours. Yeah.
I say it's my friend basket, and my friend basket's full. When someone when I drop one off, I can add you to the friend basket.
You're so annoying.
Mine doesn't. See, I don't have as much choice in it. It's like
I make a choice.
You're making like mental choice. Like I can. I'm just like, oh fuck. Right. Somebody's like, hi, I'm Tom. I'm like, I lost someone. I don't know who it was.
Oh, there goes Fred.
Right, I'm sorry. Gone. I totally interrupted.
And like,
So Fat Camp.
Yeah. Okay. So while I was doing Fat Camp, is when my mom got sick. She got diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer, and I dropped everything, and I left the show, and I left New York, and I went home to Michigan to be with her, to help her through treatment. And the goal was, like, well, the plan, you know, I always have a plan. I'm a fucking control freak. Plan was, we're going to run meds. She's going to get better, and then I'm going to go back to New York. Well, 2 years later, that's not what the plan was. She died.
Oh, I'm
and I had
sorry.
Stayed in Michigan the whole time, and I had stepped away from my career, and I hadn't done anything, and I cashed in my 401k so that I could stay, and I was working at a hair salon that was working the tanning booths for one of my best friends who owned this hair salon, and to try and make money just to help pay for, I mean, things were just rough. This was like 3 years ago.
And you had siblings?
Shit. Yes, I had an older brother and he was helping too, but my mom didn't have insurance. And so it was rough. So she passed in October, like a total fucking bitch, and just abandoned me in my time of need. And she's amazing. She put up an incredible fight and fuck, cancer just sucks, you know?
Yeah, I'm a survivor, by the way.
Yeah, well, congratulations.
Thank you.
It just, you know, it sucks. It's ravaged so many fucking people.
Did you spiral from that?
No, it didn't. Actually, it was in the strongest place of my life. I was terrified that I would. I thought, she's been my best friend forever. We were inseparable. I was so grateful to have been able to be there with her to the very, very end. We got to say goodbye up to the very last moment. I laid in the bed with her. We were right there while it happened. And it's one of the most beautiful cathartic things that's ever happened. And I was terrified that I would completely spiral, but I didn't. I was the strongest I'd ever been in my life because it gave me a perspective on life, not in the way we're like, oh, life's so short and whatever. It made me realize my whole life I've been afraid of things. I've been afraid of death. I've been afraid of these things that I created, and I've always been afraid of death. And then I saw it right in front of my face. I watched the love of my life take her last breath, and I thought to myself, that is real. That is the only thing that is real. And everything else, like, if that's what it is, and there were no trumpets, there was nothing cathartic or special or amazing about it. It was just death. And I thought, if that's what it is, if this whole thing that we do in life, if that's what it comes down to, then this is a joke. Then I can walk into these situations, these heightened situations, auditions or whatever, or these screen tests or whatever it may be. And yes, it's scary, but at the end of the day, I'm like, you're not real. This isn't real.
So you got your fearless back.
Right.
You got your fearless back.
Right. And it was like, it was just like, I felt like, fuck it.
I got goosebumps, by the way.
Like, I do too.
Just like, fuck it. Like, I just didn't have anything to lose. So I paid off my mom's car. And I bought with her life insurance money. So I had a little bit of seed money. And I moved out here. And I knew one person. I had a few friends that lived out here, but only one person I really knew well. And I was like, I don't want to go back to New York. I'm done with that. It's time for me to just like go for this and see what this life's going to be out here. It felt like the right time to come to California. And I had a manager and I had an agent at the time. And so I came out here, and incidentally, like, I came out here February of, she died in October of 2013. I moved here February 1st of 2014. And then I did Scream that following fall.
And that's where we met.
And that's where we met.
By the way, Huh. How did that happen? Because
I was, so I know Jake Wilson, and I was doing Los Feliz 90027. He hit me up to be a part of this web series, and we were filming an episode at the Rockwell, and Kate Pizakis, who I've known from New York days, she used to work at the Duplex when I was 18 and doing hairspray, used to go in there and drink and party.
Wow.
And she was running the Rockwell over there, and she was like, dude, I'm doing this fucking show. You got to be a part of it. And I was kind of like, eh, because these kinds of things in New York are a dime a dozen, and they're not very good.
Exactly.
I had no idea the Rockwell was what it was. And when she told me, like, Sarah Hyland was involved and that you were signed, like, I was like, oh, this is like a legit thing. Okay. And I didn't really know what I was signing up for, but I will tell you, the Rockwell was 90% of the traction that I got in this town because people come to fucking see those shows.
Yeah.
And incidentally, it's what started this whole sort of like next wave
surge for me.
Yeah.
I want to get into that, but your manager based out of New York or here?
My manager's here.
How did you find your manager?
We've actually known each other for a bajillion years from like my hairspray days. And he was
He's been waiting for you to come
in,
out. He's
yeah.
Like, come
yeah,
out.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Absolutely. So it just sort of worked out that way. And we had this great sort of energy where like he's really good at selling me. He knows what to do. So like he would
well,
get
you're
me
specific
into rooms.
Also.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. But he would get me into rooms that like I was up for every single pilot season since I've been here. I've been in the room for every major role. I've That's screen awesome. Tested like six times.
Can you give me
I've
his been, name and number,
I remember
please.
When I saw you at that audition for Angel show that and it was some show I can't remember what the name of it was, but anyway, it was on for like half a season.
Yeah,
but there was this sort of like bad angel that was like in the flesh.
I think
and
ended up
Carly's
to Jane Lynch or something.
Carly was up for it, and they ended up giving him to Jane Lynch.
Oh, yeah, but it's, yeah.
It makes complete sense because when you were up for it, I was like, oh yeah, absolutely, this makes sense. And even though Jane Lynch got it, which was a completely different type.
Right.
But you're both character actors.
But
it was
crazy because he was able to get me in these rooms where most people I know with much bigger credits than I couldn't. So we had this great thing going, right?
Sounds
it was
amazing.
Like, and so it just sort of went from there.
You have a lot of kismet. A lot
and
of
then,
like, fucking things happening around you,
I know,
Carly.
I know. Believe me, I know. So a year ago in August, so I had been struggling out here because I was screen testing. I mean, I was getting down to the wire on shit left and right, and it just wasn't going my way. And of course, you say to yourself, well,
the
you
next
know,
one's got to.
Right, because if I'm not meant for this, I wouldn't be getting this far, right? But then it's like eventually you're like, but why can't I fucking book? Why can't I close? What is going on? So I was bartending at Clifton's. Now, I'd never bartended before.
In downtown LA?
Yes.
I love that place.
Well, I had never bartended before, but I thought I'd be really good at it. So I faked
you're
a
like,
resume.
I know my way around a drink.
Yeah, I'm like, I know how to. So I faked my resume, and I knew the guy who was the GM at the time.
By the way, let's give a little description about Clifton's. Clifton's
because
Clifton's was
it?
It's downtown on Broadway.
Yeah.
It was open, I think, in the 30s.
It was opened in the 30s, and it's insane. It's six stories. It has like six functioning bars.
It's a cafeteria.
It was an old cafeteria.
It still is a cafeteria.
It has a giant tree in the middle of the thing that goes up through all the floors. It's really cool. It's novelty. You should definitely go.
If you like
it's
a Piccadilly,
like a museum.
Yeah.
Oh god.
You'll love if you like a Piccadilly. You'll love a Clifton's.
I love
Shoney's. But they closed for like 10 years.
Yeah. They closed down and got new owners, and then the guy who bought it, he also runs like the Edison, so they're kind of turning it into like so it became like a cocktail, like a full cocktail bar, but also like a nightclub turn and burn. So it was really stressful to work it because you're making 5-6 step cocktails, but like with fucking
like the guy from Bar Rescue would have a field day with
her. I mean, it was insane.
Yeah.
So I knew the GM, and I had been working at a catering company for a nightmare fucking woman, and I will not get into that because it's a whole thing. But I had been working with her
for no
money, and I had incidentally met this guy who had managed for us a couple events for us, and so I was like, I got to get the fuck out of here. I'm working 80 hours a week for $400 a week. I can't fucking pay my rent. I'm so stressed out. Like, I can't. My hair's falling out. Like, I got to get somewhere. And he was like, girl, come to Clifton's. And so at first I thought maybe I would do something like in the admin because that's what I had been doing. No, he like put me on his. He was like, you're not a bartender, right? I was like, yes. No. And so I had never bartended before in my life. So people were coming up being like, can I get a Sazerac? And I was like.
Yeah, I was going to say, because this is like.
I was like, you really strike me as a rum and coke kind of a girl, if I'm being honest.
Because this is like a. This this bar is,
I don't
like,
know how to make
known
that
for their mixology.
Yes.
Oh, it's not, Jesus.
It's not like, oh my God.
It's not like a vodka soda kind of bar.
Right, right.
It's like,
no, no.
You do like
rye cocktails. Yeah.
Oh
and
my God.
Side
so I had
and
to learn so fucking fast. So I was going
what
home to flash. This was just last summer.
You've got to be fucking kidding me right now. especially where your career is at, which we're going to get to. This was last summer.
This was last summer.
You're broke bartending at Clifton's.
Yeah.
Okay. Learning what a Sazerac is.
Yeah, I had like no
what
idea.
What the fuck? So you have people around you. You have the angels. I don't know what to tell you. I mean, you, there are things with
believe
you.
Me, yeah. Believe me, I know it. So I was working there and I was really, really fucking happy. I was like getting it. I was making a shit ton of money. I would only work Friday and Saturday nights and I was making like $900.
Wow.
In cash in my pocket. So I was like working two nights a week. I was making good money. I was like, this is amazing. And it would put me in the best headspace to go in an audition because I wasn't desperate, right?
And you weren't
I didn't
scared,
have to have
right?
it, and I didn't give a shit. I mean, I wanted it. Don't get me wrong. When I say, like, oh, Hollywood isn't real, I want in. Like, I want it in. I always want it.
Obviously,
in.
Yeah.
But you understood the gravity
yes,
of
absolutely,
life.
Absolutely.
And it wasn't as important.
And so I got this audition for this show called The Guest Book. It was Greg Garcia's new show. And the breakdown actually called for a black or Latino girl. And all I'd been hearing lately is how everything, like, I would get down to the wire and they'd be like, they're going ethnic. They're going ethnic. And I'm not trying to be this girl right now, but let me tell you, it's been tough. I mean, hashtag too soon, hashtag first world problems. But it's been tough for white women and
absolutely,
white men in Hollywood right
no,
now.
No, you're right.
Character well, actors, everything ethnic
no, you're
is
right.
very hot.
Thank God for me. But listen.
Yeah.
Just explain to everyone who Greg Garcia is.
So Greg Garcia created My Name is Earl and Raising Hope, The Millers, which is short-lived, which I thought was fantastic.
The man's a genius.
Also,
when it
Yes
comes...
Dear, back in the 90s,
oh,
if you recall.
Yes,
that,
yes.
That it ran for a very long time. So it called for a black or Latino girl, and I was like, oh, there's no fucking way. But I was like, you know what? I'll go in for it. What, you know, I'll just leave my shit on the floor, and we'll see what happens. So I went in. Then I got a call back. I went in the next day. They worked with me. And
at your
they,
call back, is there nothing but black and Latino girls?
Yes. I was the only white girl there.
Hilarious.
And so the next day I went in, and Greg was wonderful. He's wonderfully... normal, just sort of like you couldn't pick him out of a lineup. He's the guy that, like, if you were like, oh, he's a mogul, he's a whatever, and you saw a bunch of guys in suits and then you saw a guy shining someone's shoes, that would be Greg,
right
he
right.
would get up and you'd be like, that's the millionaire. Like, he's just he's such a fucking rad guy. So long story short, so I went in for it, and then I found out I was going to test for network, and I was like, here we fucking go again.
And what network are we at?
This is TBS.
Which is pulling out some shit, let me tell you,
insane.
This season.
Insane.
They're
insane.
Doing some shows.
Well, hello. That's The Guest Book coming out in August.
So,
what's the date? What's the date?
August 3rd.
Thank
August
you. August 3rd, 2017. We'll play
Thursday
it
nights at 10 p.m. on TBS. So... I went into network test. I was so nervous, and it was between me and this black girl, and I was like, fuck. And she had a bunch of credits. She done a bunch of Tyler Perry stuff, and I was like, well, here's what it is. Like,
too close to home by chance? I'm curious.
Which one was it? And so I was like, well, it's going to be what it's going to be. And then the very next day, so I went in, I left my heart on the floor in this audition. And the material was so, it was one of those shows where you say to yourself, even if I don't get this, I'll watch it.
Yeah.
Do you coach at all before?
I don't.
So it's sort of like, because.
I mean, I'll run it with friends and stuff that I trust, actor
friends. No, but like,
because
I'm an actor that needs a good coaching, right? Unless it's like, unless it's comedic or
but
whatever.
But here's the thing. I don't think it's a matter of some people need it and some people don't. I'm sure I could fucking use it. I just don't.
No, but see, the difference is that you're probably a really good auditioner.
Yes and no. I
think
mean,
it's the theater thing too. When you've been through 10 auditions for Tracy Turnblatt, at some point you've got to be like, oh shit, you better know how to audition.
Here's
girl.
The thing, because of you the know? Process that theater teaches you, when I come into audition, I'm showing you exactly what I do with the role, right? There is no, like, you know what I mean? Like, I've done the work. I know who this person is going to be for me, and this is either what you're going to buy or you're not.
Yeah. So, and you can give me an adjustment and we'll see where I take
yeah,
it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, like,
absolutely.
I am who I am. My comedy is who
this
I am.
This is what I do.
Yeah.
Is this show, is it a 1 hour?
No, it's a half hour.
Half hour.
There's some half hour. Yeah.
Great multi-cam.
People. Yeah.
So Lauren Lapkus is on this show.
Yeah. So we so I found out the following week or the following day after the network test that I booked it, and Greg Garcia called me himself. It was really sweet.
He did. What did he say?
So I was waiting that day to hear, and I was like, I was freaking out and I was texting my manager, and I was like, I don't know if I can fucking go through this again. I don't know if I can do this again. Like, this is my seventh network test. You know, whatever. And he's like, girl, let's just stay positive. Let's just see what happens. And I was like, okay. And then so about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, my manager texts me and says, hey, I forget, do you work tonight or tomorrow night? It was a Thursday. And I was like, tomorrow night, why? And he didn't answer. And I thought, okay, well, that's weird, because I knew that if anything ever happened, we'd been together at this point for 3 years. If anything ever happened, I knew he would come over to my house, right? Mm-hmm. So I was like, that's weird. But I was like, you know what? You can't be thinking about that right now. You just put that phone down. So I was sitting there.
You're going to have to make a sidecar tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly.
Sazerac sidecar.
I'm going to have to, like, just go back to my flashcards.
Mango margarita.
Yeah.
Oh, God. The first time somebody asked me, side note, for a daiquiri, I told them, we don't have a blender. And they were like, no, bitch, like a classic daiquiri, like rum and simple and lime juice. And I was like, I know. I just wanted you to know that I can't make it frozen.
I'll be in the back room for 5 to 10 minutes.
I also, when people would ask me for things, I would tell them that we didn't have that if I didn't know what it was. And they'd be like, it's right on the shelf behind you. I'm like, oh, my God, we just got that in. That must have just come in. Hilarious. They'd be like, do you have monkey shoulder? And I'd be like, oh, we don't have that. And they're like, no, it's right there. And I was like, oh, Barbax.
Sorry.
Also, I'm like, which one are you pointing at?
With the monkey on it?
Yeah. So it's like 1 o'clock. So at 1:08, I'm just sitting on the edge of my bed, like thinking like a crazy person, staring at the TV. Friends was on. And my phone rings and I look down and it's a long story short, but I had talked to Greg on the phone the day before, the day of my screen test, because there was this whole other thing. So the whole other part of it is that because the show is kind of risque, I had to sign a nudity clause. Now, I was never nude. It was never anything like that. But because there's sexual insinuating sex and simulating sex, like I had to fake give a hand job. Of course, it's Greg Garcia. So anyways, I had this long conversation with him before I signed it, because
he wanted you to feel
he wanted
comfy.
Me to feel comfortable about it. He did on the phone. Didn't even block his phone number. Like, called me from his cell phone. Like, this is Greg.
Do you want to give it out right now?
And yes, I do. And we basically had this conversation. I said, listen, here's my thing. It's not so much about the nudity as it is, like, I'm very comfortable in my skin, and my wardrobe is my issue. I want to make jokes. I don't want to be a joke. That's the difference,
so
right?
Well put.
And I said, I will take risks and I will do things that most girls won't, but I won't do anything that I know doesn't look good, that I wouldn't work. Like, I'm not going to be in Daisy Dukes in a tube top with things hanging out that shouldn't be. I was raced right. You put Lycra on your legs. Like, there's just certain things you won't do. So he was like, look, this is how I see her. I think she's, because she owns a strip club. That's her thing, right? She's cool.
Is she abroad?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, it's insane. She's tough. I play the villain. She's like the villain of the show. So
excited for the show.
So the whole thing, you know, was he was like, I see her as being strong and sexy. And he was like, Carly, you will have final say and like all this stuff. I mean, he gave me carte blanche over things that so anyways, I had his phone number in my phone. So I'm sitting there and my phone rings and I look down, it says Greg Garcia.
And you're like, this could go one of two ways.
And
right
I
now.
Did. I was like, either A of all, it's a butt dial, right? It's just a fucking mistake. I was like, or he's calling to be like, you did such a good job yesterday.
And I'll think about you for
and
something in
I
the
would love
future.
To write something for you. All this bullshit I've heard in the past. Or this is the phone call that's going to change my life forever. And then I was like, oh, fuck, I guess I should answer it. And so I picked up the phone and I was like, hello. And he's like, hey, Carly, it's Greg. I was like, yeah, I know.
Remember when I saved your number? Oh, wait, I'm not stalking you. Anyway, what do you want?
What? And he was like, yeah, so listen, I just wanted to call you and let you know that you got the role. And when I tell you that I fell out, I started screaming into the phone. I told him to go fuck himself. I was like, go fuck yourself. Are you fucking kidding me right now?
We're soulmates.
I know.
Exactly,
I told you would love her.
Exactly.
I told you.
I was like, I was like, do not fuck with me, Greg. Don't fuck with me, dude. And he was like, I'm not fucking with you. She's yours. And I just started crying. And he was amazing. So then we went into work. So we filmed all last fall. We had the most amazing guest stars on our show. I mean, there's huge people on the show.
What number are you on the call sheet? What number are you on the call sheet?
Three.
Okay, girl.
Say it.
Three. Who's one and two?
Charlie Robinson is number one. Yay. And Aloma Wright was number two.
Well, of course.
You can't.
Sorry.
In front of her.
One day, though.
Yeah, who is on the show? Tell people.
So,
tell the people.
So it's an anthology. This season is an anthology season, so it's really cool. There's three series regulars. Myself, actually, it's Loma wasn't technically a series regular, which is weird, but that's anyways, whatever. But she's
probably contractual.
Fine with me. Not a problem. She is so much fun to veer on. Yeah. She taught me so much about SAG and pensions and stuff.
Well, that's why
she literally, I was sitting there being like, and she was like, girl, get yourself a pet, get in that SAG, get up, make sure you follow your dues, that it's worth it. She was like, I get my check every month. I was like,
oh,
yeah.
Sure.
So there's three series regulars. It's myself, a guy named Lou Wilson, and Charlie Robinson, and we're like the townspeople. My character runs a strip club, and I have a stepson who, we're like anomalies in age. Like, he's 25, but we never say how old I am. Like, I could be 40, I could be 14, no one knows. He's like my little minion. I play the villain, and he like does all my bidding for me. And then Charlie, so it takes place at a cabin rental. And Charlie runs the cabin rental with his wife, played by Loma Wright. And every week we have new guest stars that come in and they stay at the cabin where all these crazy things ensue, and they write their stories in the guest book. So like Lauren Lapkus did an episode. Stocker Channing did an episode. Presley did an episode. Kate Micucci came in with Michael Rapaport. Oh my God, Michaela Watkins did an episode.
So funny.
I mean, just unreal.
I love a
Cheryl
series.
Cheryl Underwood?
I love a series that's one-offs like that. But yeah, that there are people, like I'm a big fan of High Maintenance on HBO, yeah, because I love that, right, he's the only thing that the through line, yes, but that each episode is like a different story.
Yeah, and that's sort of what's really fun about it. Like we are the constant. So my character.
Where do you shoot?
We shot it in Santa Clarita, and then we shot on location up in Pine Mountain, which is like a mountain town north of Santa Clarita.
Cool.
And so we shot it all here in California. And so my character is the villain, and the way that she makes her money is she brings men into her VIP room, also known as the storage closet. It's just like a recliner in a storage closet.
Yes.
And she videotapes it, and so she blackmails people to try and get money. She just wants to get out of the town. Oh, Tommy Dewey. I got to like have a whole love arc thing with Tommy Dewey one episode, and he's as dreamy as it gets. He's on Casual. If you watch the show,
oh, yeah,
he is just dreamy McDreamy and so sweet. We got to make out, and the whole time I was like trying to be really professional about it, but I tried to shove my tongue in his mouth like 47 times. Like, literally, I was like, I'm super method. Also, put my tongue in your asshole. Like, I was no joke. Like, just going to make... I was like, I'm going to get it. I'm going to get it. Well, I can. I'm just going to do it. Because
I'm getting paid for this.
Because I don't care.
So... You shot a full season already?
Yeah, we shot 10 episodes. We got ordered straight to series. So we shot 10 episodes, and so it airs again, premieres August 3rd.
August 3rd, TBS. Don't miss it. The guest book.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then, because I know you have to go soon.
Yes. So, sure.
So then tell me about your other huge job.
So then
I'm curious how you're allowed to do this job.
Yeah. So, okay. Right. So I'm under contract, but I'm allowed to do guest starring stuff. So the way that they sort of got around with it with Amazon, it's weird with streaming stuff too. Like, networks and streaming aren't necessarily in competition. It's like a whole new weird world. So you're sort of allowed, there's sort of a gray area there. A little bit of a little bit more leeway than normal. But so this came about for One Mississippi, which if you haven't seen season one, it's just fucking worth it. I'm not on season one, but you have to go. It's Tig Notaro's show. Louis C.K. executive produces. Diablo Cody created it. It's so fucking good. It's dark comedy. It's real. And for those who don't know a lot about Tig, like, her whole story was she got diagnosed with cancer. I believe she had a double mastectomy. She got diagnosed with C. diff, which is like a debilitating digestional disease, and then her mom died. Mm-hmm. And it was like this crazy thing. And so the show is loosely based. It's a biography about her life, but there's fictional stuff in there. And so it is one of the smartest and most truthful tellings of death that I've ever seen in my life, because death is really weird and funny and gross and not necessarily beautiful, and like and strange things happen. And so it is a dark comedy. Excuse me. So when season two came about and this role came out, it was for, they only do six episodes a season. And when the call for season two came out and they were looking for this reoccurring role to play the love interest of Noah Harpster's character, Remy, who plays Tig's brother. It was for 5 out of the 6 episodes, and it was a huge storyline. Mm-hmm. And it was this crazier. She's this Southern gal. She's super Christian. She's got a 9-month-old baby. And, I mean, it's hilarious. And she's just super unfiltered and says the most insane things. Yeah. And she just knows what she knows. And she'll make comments about, you know, homosexuality, and she's like, I just don't know about that life. I just don't know. God did not make those parts together, but you know what? Bless their cotton socks. You know, like, she's just kind of that. She's that Southern girl who's love like, it. You know what? It's not for me, but you know what? Live your life.
Right.
Like, and live your life in hell, but like, that's fine for you. That's just sort of how she
just get me a Mary Kay lipstick.
You know what I'm saying? Like, feel like I'll go get my hair done by them. Yeah. You know what I mean? All day long. But like, I don't know. They're going to hell. So it's precious. Wow. And so it was really fun to kind of play this character and find a way to try and make her redeeming.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
yeah.
It's such an unredeemable things that will come out of her mouth. But to try and find a way to make her lovable. So we filmed that this summer. I was incredibly, incredibly grateful for this to come about. It felt so full circle for me because of how deeply her story and the way she talked about her mom's death and the way that her mom died and how yeah. she was there in that moment just felt really.
And you must have bonded over.
Oh my God. Yeah. We certainly did.
We talked
so
about that.
It was such an incredible experience wow. for me to be able to work on something that like meant that much to me.
What? That when is that awesome. Air?
So that comes out, I believe, September 8th or 9th. I'm not sure exactly
it's
yet,
a very,
it's on Amazon.
It's a very big fall for Carly Gibson, everyone.
Listen, we got her first before she does all that. Before she
this
does a GMA
official,
and all
this
that
is
shit.
My official first like yeah. interview. Yeah.
Listen, here. Carly.
I got to direct her a couple weeks ago. And
no
I
one cares about you, Christine. Quit no, making it about you.
It's all about me.
You got a
Jesus
baby.
Jesus Christ.
You got
enough.
Fine.
You went from teenage Broadway star to drug addict.
Yeah.
To an ill mother who passed away. To now going to be a huge television star.
Don't forget Sazerac.
Oh yeah,
bartender.
Sorry,
bartender.
For Clifton's.
There's
by the
a
way,
Sazerac moment.
By the way, I want to go to Clifton's with you.
Yes, we'll totally
I
want
to go to Clifton's.
Yeah, I want to take Christine for the
yeah,
first
we'll
time
go.
To Clifton's.
Let's do
okay.
it.
Yeah, let's do it.
We're going to Clifton's because that's a great idea.
Yeah. Yeah. To singing her tits off and Scream.
Right. To doing Scream
with my stupid ass.
To now you're doing these huge shows, which I think are going to be huge hits. I mean. You have to come back after the fact because I have a feeling there's going to be so much more with you. You're the worst guest we've ever had.
The worst.
Listen, we've had Emmy nominees. We've had Tony nominees.
We have no winners, but I think with Carly.
We have no winners, but I think with you.
I feel like with Carly, we
I
have
think
a
with
shot.
You, there's a shot.
There's a shot.
If you win, you have to come back.
Okay. Okay. It's a deal. It's a promise.
Carly, tell the people where they can find you.
Any street corner,
perfect.
Pretty much. So all of my social media is just at Carly Gibson, CarlyJibson. Not to be confused with Carly Rae Jepsen. I get it. We're both super tall and thin right. and dark yeah. haired.
And you
we
can
could
both
not
sing.
Be, we could not
one
be
is
any more similar.
Maybe the other.
Is that the Call Me Maybe girl?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Go ahead.
And that's all I have to say about that. So that's where you can find me on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. And let me tell you this, though. I'm going to fucking disclaim this shit right now. Don't come for me if I say something on my fucking social media that you don't like. I'm really outspoken.
Good.
I have opinions about things. I'm incredibly politically charged. So I love the following is lovely and the support is so I'm grateful for it. But do not fucking come for
no,
me.
No, and you're a good
do
Republican.
Not fucking
you are
come
a good
for
Republican.
Me. I am just a good old fashioned conservative Republican girl. No.
Carly,
I'm
you
kidding,
are...
by the way. She's very left. The bitch is left.
Yeah, if you're not into that, you may not want to hear the rant. Carly, we're so thankful. Thank you for coming
Thanks
and being
a
on
lot.
The show. It's a pleasure and an honor to have you, and I couldn't be more happy for you because you're just so talented and you're such a sweet person. And I always, you're so good, and I always knew that.
All right, Christine, you talk too much. Say goodbye.
Jesus. If you want to find us on social media, you can find me at Yo Lakin.
Or at me, Alec. At me,
oh, my God.
The
oh,
bourbon. Just... Alec Led. Alec Led.
Thank you as well to Stephen Ray Morris. Where can we find you, Stephen?
Whoa. I also had it too. At Stephen Ray Morris.
Yeah, see?
If you want to tweet us or talk about this episode, definitely email us at worsteverpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks so much. We'll hear you next week.
Bye.
Bye, y'all.